Hello, and welcome to Anarchy SF, the podcast companion to the Anarchy SF website. I am Yanai, and with me as always is...
Hello, it is Eden.
With me as always is hello.
That's a nice name.
So, I'll jump right to it because I don't have like something silly to open with. We are talking about Spire.
Yes.
Second time talking about an RPG.
Mm-hmm.
A pen and paper RPG. You could count some video games as RPGs too. And when we talk about an RPG, I think there are two things we're going to talk about. One is like the background story that every RPG pretty much has,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, itself can have anarchist themes. But there's also the experience of playing that we tried to get into when we were talking about Shadowrun.
Right.
And, you know, the way that it makes you experience being part of a world. So do you want to give us a rundown of what Spire is about?
Sure. Spire is a game published by Rowan, Rook, and Deckard that have also published such games as Honey Heist, which was very popular when it was released, as well as some other smaller ones. And they have also published Spire and its sequel, Heart, which was designed, both of those were designed by Grant Howitt and Christopher Taylor. And basically, you could categorize Spire and Heart as an indie role-playing game, although that definition is also quite interesting, I would say. It's not D&D, right? So it becomes indie, right? It doesn't have the full might of Wizards of the Coast and Hasbro behind it.
Yeah, it's not D&D, and it's not one of the like D&D competitors.
Yeah, and it's also not like, you know, World of Darkness, right? It's not one of those like big established names. It's a relatively new game. It won, well, Heart at least won seven 2021 Annie Awards for best writing and setting and design. And Spire was also very, very, very well received. And the premise, basically, which we'll dive into a lot deeper later, is that there is a city called Spire. No one knows where this city came from. The city takes the form of a tower, towering into the sky. Perhaps it's precursor technology. Perhaps it's just a city. Perhaps it's something else. And this city was ruled for many, many generations by the Drow. And if you're not like... 80s grown or 90s grown nerd, then Drow are dark elves, right? But recently the high elves or the Aelfir conquered Spire as part of their uber racist genocidal war against the Drow, and now they run Spire, and they run it as a racial hegemony, right? They discriminate against the Drow. While some Drow are allowed to participate in politics and hold even high offices, they are all puppets and they serve the Aelfir cause. The religion of the Drow is outlawed. What's called the Ministry of the Hidden Mistress, of our Hidden Mistress, sorry, is outlawed.
Mm-hmm.
And only the pantheon of the High Elves can be worshipped, or this colonialized version of the Drow religion, which is the sanctioned one, the colonial version of our Hidden Mistress, which Drow are also allowed to worship, and of course, as you know, as a direct parable to how Christianity was used, this colonial religion, Our Glorious Lady, you know, preaches subservience and nonviolence and empathy and all that stuff. You play as rebels. Like, inherently as rebels, you can't play as collaborators or as just normal people. You play as rebels trying to bring down the Aelfir rule with the very important distinction that you're operating in cells. Right? There is no movement. The movement has to operate in secret. It's a bunch of individuals divided into cells. You can't trust anyone. Anyone might be a collaborator or an informer. And in this sort of paranoid ambiance or theme, you have to try to resist the all-powerful Aelfir rule. That's basically it.
Yeah. So we're not gonna have a spoiler break here because you can't really spoil an RPG, but I'll say before we get into themes that interestingly, drow in this game are kind of a mishmash of every kind of racialization that exists. So you've kind of mentioned them as occupied by colonialism, right? The Elfir as colonialists that come from the north. There's also some degree of enslavement. Interestingly, they don't. The Drow aren't enslaved because explicitly the writers of the game said that they weren't sure that they are capable of handling this topic of slavery in a responsible way within an RPG, so they don't want actual slavery to be part of their core, although obviously, like any GM can do what they want with the game. And instead, there's a system of indentured service
Yeah, the duress.
that Drow. Yeah, Doran,
Doran,
sorry.
sorry.
That Drow go through if they want to be part of kind of normal society. And
I have to say that I actually enjoy that over the concept of slavery because I think I might say something that's controversial here, right? But I think that people in the West use slavery as the extreme which washes everything lesser. Right? Like, there's no slavery. What do you want? Everything's okay, right? It's easy to kind of like
yes.
hand wave it away, whereas the durance is more like how things work today in the West to create slavery by any other name. Right?
Yes, I agree. I think one thing that would tend to happen if you did act out slavery would be that you would be drawn towards stories of heroism, you know, breaking slaves, like killing slavers, that would all be justified. And here you have like a tiny bit more nuance, and that would actually make you think harder about how this kind of society works. What are the insidious and pernicious ways of exploitation rather than like, oh, slavery. So it's just like a fight to the death, because I think it's obvious to most people that a slave has a right to kill their
Yeah,
enslavers.
and that ties it.
So
Go ahead.
just
Go ahead.
carrying on like a couple more ways. So another thing about the Drow is that there's an implication, and it's not directly claimed, although it is, I think, hinted at by the book, that the Drow were made into what they are by the Elfia. What they are is cursed, not to be able to survive the sunlight, and also they're kind of like weird, not exactly mammals because they lay eggs for their children. So we have this kind of racialization where there's an original wound, like they're made into a subservient race by way of violence. So we have both colonialism and themes of slavery. Again, not slavery exactly by its name, but you know, dark skins, like
Servitude.
a lot of things get evoked. Yeah, servitude. And so I think a lot of what we're going to talk about is racialization. I think we've mentioned racialization before, but it's important to know that the way that race gets conceptualized by pretty much anyone serious talking about race nowadays is that race is a social construct created to create hierarchies between individuals of different ethnic groups.
Yeah, and I think especially.
That's a kind of simplistic way of saying it, but yeah.
Yeah, I think diving in a bit deeper, I think especially Spire does a very good job of, I don't know if this is intentional. I follow Grant Yuaton on Twitter, maybe I can ask him, but it seems to allude to the idea that whiteness only exists in opposition. Like if you think about it, there is no such thing as a white race, right? I mean this in the genetic and biological sense, right? If you ask people don't think about this, but if you ask them, where do white people come from? They'll give you as diverse an answer as Germany, Northern India, if they're especially racist, right? And they want to make the Aryan thing, the Caucasus Mountains, and that's why they're called Caucasians, or a vague like pointing towards the north, right? And those four areas have nothing in common. right? As far as race. So,
yeah, I mean, you could go further, you know, Jesus is conceptualized as white. Mm-hmm. I think it's fun to say, like, oh, Jesus was probably had brown skin, but that doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Whiteness is not about having a specific, like, color of skin. Whiteness is about being part of the dominant group.
Exactly. Go ahead.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
So, you have a bunch of white people who are white in virtue of being part of the dominant group, and then they also have a place that they came from. So you have Irish people, and you have Polish people, yeah. and you have Italian people. And once you start thinking about all these different places, you also start seeing, you know, that they're different people with different histories and different
yeah.
things about them. But the whiteness only unites them in the sense that they are supreme over a different race
right.
by force.
And especially not black, right? So this yeah. harkens back to, of course, Frantz Fanon, although, of course, a lot of water has gone under the bridge since his time. But he's maybe not the first, but one of the most, you know, effective and graphic descriptions of this. And we already spoke about this, right, when we spoke about River Solomon and their work. But this mm-hmm. is a really interesting way of making it explicit. And also adding to it something which we've already discussed before, the Hegelian idea of the power that the servant has over the master, right? Very much the dynamic mm-hmm. between the Drow and the Aelfir is that the Aelfir are disconnected from everything, right? From like how they're literally apathetic, right? In the book, it says that they perform these like super weird and awful rituals just to feel something, right? They'll mutilate themselves. They'll butcher their own people or their own body in order to live forever or stuff like that. Just to feel something, because they're so disconnected from the world. Whereas the Drow, partly by virtue of their biology, by the way, like, for example, laying eggs, you don't then tend the specific egg, right? You lay dozens of them, and then they're all communally looked over by the matrons. It makes for a more communal society, right? And because they run Spire, they run everything, they make the food, most of the guards are Drow collaborators, right? But most of the guards are Drow, frontline soldiers, all that stuff. They are the ones that are actually, you know, in touch with reality, inspire, and the world around them. And that is, if they could tap into it, that is the power that they hold over the Aelfir. And that's a lot of what your characters are trying to do. Again, something which would be familiar, I think, to... So the echoes in this book, slight historical tangent, is very much that of 1848, rather than the Communist Revolution or the French Revolution.
So the Paris Commune?
Yeah, so before the Paris Commune, right? So this is the Spring of the Peoples, right? Both in France, mm-hmm. where you have the series of revolutions against first the... What's happening to me today? The Orleanist branch of the monarchy. First by big liberals... And then that spirals out of control, and there's a military revolution which ends up putting Bonaparte III on the throne of France, but also, of course, in Germany, which then leads to the unification of Germany, and Austria, and Hungary, and Italy, of course, and all over Europe. So if you're imagining, like, the vibe of this game, it's very much, you know, guns exist, but they're very new and experimental. Factories cover everything with smog. Transportation exists but is difficult, and sort of the old world has died, the medieval order has died, but modernity has mm-hmm. not been fully born. And, you know, to quote Gramsci, a host of morbid conditions appears, right? Like people live in squalor and disease and injury and so on. And in this fermentation, in this like fever of industry and progress and so on, lies the revolutionary fervor. One last note.
Is this also the setting for La Miserable?
Yeah. La Miserable happens... I keep forgetting like which one of the French revolutions La Miserable is about, but it is very much of that time. Wait, I'm Googling it. Why shouldn't I Google it? So Victor Hugo wrote it in 1862 and was exactly about... I think it was actually about the revolution in 1831, which was a short-lived one.
1815 to 1832.
Exactly. So 1831, 1832 is a failed revolution called the July Days against, once again, the Orleanists, right? And Louis-Philippe, who was the king that was after Napoleon, he was kind of tried to resurrect the French crown. So I would say that Spire is a bit ahead of that, right? We already have like mass industrialization. There's a train. Well, we'll talk about the train very shortly. But there's a train. There's stuff like that. There's a distant war. So it fits 48 to 71, where you get the Paris Commune, right? More than I would say Les Miserables, but it's definitely, you know, a lot of the same vibes. If you think about the dejection of Jean Valjean and like the horrible conditions in which people live in Les Miserables, it's very much familiar to what Spire wants to discuss and wants to say. One last note on themes. I don't know if we discussed this before, but one of the most influential shows on this kind of like scene of role-playing is Peaky Blinders. And Peaky Blinders is set in the UK in the beginning of the 20th century and famously influenced Blades in the Dark. Like the people who wrote Blades in the Dark said that they cite it in the book, and it also influenced Spire. So again, industrial cities, you know, rebellion bubbling up from the bottom up, crime, violence, the elite, all that stuff. So if you're looking for more thematic waypoints to figure out what Spire is about, then you should also cite this. And by the way, add to this like weird magic, cosmic horror, magical realism in certain ways, and just in general like fantasy vibes.
Yeah. So I want to jump in on a point you mentioned about the Elfil. And that's kind of the part of the master-slave dynamic. Mm-hmm. So the master-slave dynamic is kind of relegated to continental philosophy. It's a metaphor. It's not like an argument.
Yeah.
And there's a book that does something that I wouldn't say is similar, but kind of rhymes. And we discussed it before going on online, which is Jose Medina's Epistemology of Resistance. Mm-hmm. And he does a bunch of stuff there, but one of the things he does is he takes a point from a theory that we talked about in our first episode, standpoint theory, the theory that people who are oppressed have a unique standpoint, which gives them more knowledge about society from that standpoint, which is kind of the epistemic grounds for listening to oppressed people to understand their condition. And he kind of wants to talk about the way that not having a standpoint, that being part of the elite group, can harm you epistemically, can make you a worse knower. So for a good example of that, you have the very popular movie Parasite, which also deals with the same themes, right? You have the rich family being oblivious because they are kind of above everything that is happening. So Medina talks about different forms of epistemic vice. One way, epistemic vice meaning, you know, habits that you acquire that make you a worse knower. So in this case, habits that you would acquire by belonging to the dominant group. So one of the things he talks about is colorblindness and kind of the thought of what kind of person you would have to be to think that colorblindness is a good idea.
Yeah.
So to intentionally lose information. And he also talks about how being part of a dominant group means having your knowledge challenged less.
Mm-hmm.
So you get kind of epistemic hubris.
Yeah.
So you just assume that you know and you don't examine your beliefs enough. And I think the characters that exemplify this in Spire are the Elfir and their disconnected ways.
Yeah.
So the Elfir are very weird, and it's not... So one thing is that they don't feel anything, but another is that they have so much power that everything is a game to them, and they become extremely weird, and they have...
They're sadists, right?
They're sadists, which is more like the trying to feel anything.
Yeah.
And they have weird rituals and weird ideas. They all wear masks at all time, which is obviously a dig at kind of repressed society where, right, like you wear a mask, you have to adopt some kind of persona just to deal with other people. And the idea is that in order to maintain supremacy, you have to turn yourself into a weirdo. And if you want to see like what that rhymes with in reality, you can look at kind of conservative insanity. So sometimes when you look at like, I don't know, you can think about QAnon, you can think about people who like or like are emotionally invested. I don't mean like anyone who voted for Donald Trump or anything, but like people who are like emotionally invested in his like greatness can sometimes seem very weird. If you watch Fox News, it's sometimes like a fever dream. Never mind that like MSNBC is its own fever dream. So some of it is extremely weird. You have to invent weirder and weirder scenarios. You know, people in the government are eating babies, and like pedophilia is like a bigger problem than it is, and we all have to talk about it all the time. And it's just because, like, you live in the US where there are so many problems, so many solvable problems, where if you compare the US to any other state, any other country, you'll immediately see the problems that plague the US and that are worth talking about, but nobody talks about them, and instead they talk about weird stuff because the problematic structure in the US, the opioid crisis is meant to keep down like poor whites. The drug war is here to keep down poor non-whites. You have the mental health, not the mental health, I'm sorry, the health insurance thing that is meant to keep down anyone who isn't bourgeoisie.
Yeah.
So you have all these systems that are there to maintain supremacy, and they suck so bad that if you allowed yourself to look at them, you would immediately see like what the problems are and be forced to talk about fixing them because nothing else makes sense. But you can't do that, so you have to be a weirdo all the time. And I think the Elfir are like a really good kind of villain or antagonist to interact with because they're so they embody the dissonance between being so powerful and such an idiot.
Yeah, I think also it's interesting to think about the manifestation of that weirdness in the actual personality of the powerful. And this is something that Spire does really well when describing the Elfir. All of the Elfir are extreme individuals, right? They don't even share names. So instead of, you know, my name is Eden and yours is Yanai, which is pretty non-common names, right? But if someone's called John, then there's like millions of other Johns, right? And it's a very limited form of community, but it is the pool of names which we draw from relates to our culture and our history and so on. Here, each elf, or Elfir, sorry, High Elf, has this own super personalized name, like ink flowing across the water at sunset, stuff like that. And they're all unique, right? And they're all divided. And the Elfir themselves are all about displaying their own special personality in their own special way. And then you think about these cases where, for example, Michael Gove of the conservative British government had this hilarious video of him trying to clap and failing, like to clap like a person, right? Or more recently, the Canadian deputy minister, you know, she announced the usage of the Emergencies Act to freeze bank accounts of protesters involved in truckers involved in the recent protests. And she had this super weird moment when she started laughing and then suddenly realized that she completely read the room wrong and in an instant become serious. So of course there's all these jokes about like, you know, flesh suits and these people being reptilians or robots or whatever, but the reality is just these people are so disconnected from how to act, how to live, how to convincingly be human like the rest of us, because they are used to running in such a rarefied and hyper individualistic in circles, right, that they in those circles being weird and outspoken and odd and having your own like mannerisms and body language is encouraged, right? You can think about all the stories from Hollywood and how people act and what they do and how they speak to each other. It seems surreal because it is a different world and a different way to look at the world. And I want to also go ahead.
I'm glad you mentioned Hollywood because that reminds me of a different part of epistemic vice that I think is really interesting. So, you know, after Me Too, like you had a series of people with allegations thrown against them, and it's just depressing, right? Like every week, and I'm not trying to insinuate in any way that it's bad that these things come out. They should come
Yeah, of
out.
course.
But it is depressing to hear, like, oh God, just every each one of these people are bad. And at some point, my breaking point was like Joss Whedon, which was like so predictable, and it was like, oh, of course, him too. And you know, I'm sitting there and I'm like, are we just going to live in a world where these people do these bad things and we keep hearing about it to like always after 20
Yeah.
years? Because it's not like a coincidence that a lot of people in power are these terrible kinds of people. It's that once you get so much power, you lose all check on your personality.
And that's
When
that,
you're.
yeah, and
Sorry.
that ties into exactly what I wanted to say and actually quote from the book, on page two, the numbered pages, right? Because you have the index and table of contents and all that stuff. They set up the themes of the book in a section called What is Fantasy? There's like a few bullet points, and one of them is there is no morality system, by which they mean no one thinks they're the bad guy. Everyone believes their actions are justified. No spell is going to let you detect whether someone's chaotic evil or not. Obviously, you get D&D, of course, which is useful because you might have to do some reprehensible things to free your people and lie to your family about it. So we'll get into that l last part soon, but the first part is exactly how reality works. And if we tie it back to epistemology, we're talking about moral epistemology, right? Which is the question, what tools do you use to find out moral facts? For example, am I good or bad? Or is a certain action morally justified or not? You can answer the question itself, which is unfortunately where a lot of this discourse ends up living, right? Talking about the specific examples. But it's rarer to have a discussion about what are the tools and suppositions and axioms that we use to even answer this question in the first place. And that also leads us to the second bullet point, or the one below that. There aren't any monsters, right? And that's also how reality works. So there's this very childish idea, which unfortunately people, it sticks with them, right, into maturity, which is the idea of monsters. If you were to press Harvey Weinstein against the wall, or Louis C.K., or any one of these people, and there weren't any cameras, and they weren't like, there wasn't any interest for them to lie. Maybe you threaten their live parody satire in Minecraft, and you force them to be truthful, and you ask them, is it good for men to abuse women? Right? They would say no. Right?
Sure.
Almost every single person on the planet, except for people with either specific mental conditions or a very different and alien sort of way to look at the world, would say no to the blunt, bare question of, is it good for one person to cause suffering to another? But then
Sure.
you retreat the knife, right? Like you put your knife away, or suddenly the cameras are on, and you ask them, okay, but was it good for you to do this specific instance of that? And that's where the epistemology comes in. Because they'll start saying things like, you don't understand, it's not that simple, I was under duress, I suffer from mental illness myself, they wanted it, they asked it, look at what they wore, look at how they walked, blah, 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 all that stuff.
Yeah, you can look at the, if you're interested in this specific phenomenon, you could look at like Louis C.K.'s original
Yeah.
apology when things came out about him, which is f chock full of like, obviously I know that what I did is wrong, but also I'm a baby. I don't know.
Right,
Like
so
I'm capable of.
bringing it back to racialization and also to Spire and to our current conditions, it is very rare. It exists, right? Because everything exists, but it's very rare for someone to say, "I am racist. I am a racist. I believe that black people are inferior to whites because of their genes." Instead, they'll say they're lazy, they're violent, they have bad upbringing, all their fathers are missing. They'll find all of these excuses to not deal with the moral epistemological fact that what they're doing is bad. And that's how it works in Spire as well. The Aelfir are not evil, right? If you catch one of them in the game and ask them why they're subjugating the Drow, they won't laugh maniacally and turn into a cloud of bats and fly away.
Sure.
They'll say, I'm not subjugating the Drow. The Drow are subjugating themselves, right? They were born to be a slave race. They were born, they like it better when we do it this way. And if
yeah, well, it's the Stoic idea of like the noble burden of.
Yeah, exactly. And if this.
Know, the slave matter benefiting the slave.
Exactly.
Teaching them,
and if this sounds like something familiar, that's because this is real life shit that racists say, right? Now, why is this so important, and how is it mobilized and inspired to make its point? So resistance inspire, sure, it's, you know, banding together and actually fighting and burning down factories and shit like that, but it's also getting all the other Drow to understand that they are thinking with the tools of the Aelfir, right? That when they worship the Our Glorious Lady, right, the pacified version of their religion, they are bowing themselves or bowing their heads to the Aelfir perspective on the world. They are accepting the moral epistemology of the oppressor. So a lot of, like, one of the characters in the book, there's no classes if you're a D&D player, there's no, like, the fighter and mage and stuff like that, but there are, like,
roles,
right, broad roles. One of them is the Firebrand, right? And what the Firebrand does is riles up people and gets them passionate enough to act, to break free of these systems. Another one, the Ink Smith or Ink Wright, something like that, is a journalist, right? And through their journalism, they expose the lie of the Aelfir perspective on reality. They can also, like, summon a gunman into scenes and do other weird stuff, but a lot of their powers are, like, spreading rumor and undermining Aelfir society and so on. And that's really cool because that's how actual resistance was built in the actual reality, right? Like, it's not a coincidence that Lenin, and we'll come back to Lenin in a sec, that Lenin was a journalist.
It's always Lenin with
It's always Lenin with me. Was a journalist. And a lot of the other people who worked in 1848, that is, a lot of the action there happened through newspapers in France and in other, you know, places that can resist the axioms and the a priori assumptions of power on how goodness and badness is measured or doled out, right? So resistance is not just physical.
I remember I was I visited the Museum of the Resistance to the Nazis in Berlin. It's a very sad museum because this is specifically German resistance to the Nazis. And it was very hard to resist the Nazis as a German, because if you didn't resist them, you would live a comfortable life, you were fine. If you did, so all the groups in there all share the same story. It's a bunch of students, they start handing out pamphlets, and then they all get executed. It's brutal. Like, you have the White Rose, and it's just like people spreading, like, the tiniest bit of information. And it's funny, because, you know, we're Jews, we grew up on, like, the stories of Jewish resistance, which is, like, you know, guns, because Jews didn't have any choice. So if there was resistance, it was physical uprising, joining the partisans, getting armed, fighting, because, you know, it's last resort time. And, you know, with the Germans, even, like, spreading a little bit of information around, if you watch Jojo Rabbit, that's also, like, one of the characters there who's a resistor, like, she gets executed for doling out flyers. It was a very common thing. Just the idea that the party isn't right for Germany is dangerous and gets snuffed out, like, really violently.
Yeah, and that also brings us to my second point. You know, when we're discussing epistemology, we're talking about how knowledge is built, right? This is a very common, like, literary criticism, leftist, postmodern kind of idea, the construction of knowledge, right? How you build, so everybody knows what a social construct is, but social constructs can also be pieces of knowledge, right? Like, how to categorize. One of the famous examples is the Europeans reach, quote unquote, the New World, and they have to start categorizing the trees, right? Like, what types of trees are there? Which trees do you want to cut down to make ships? Which do you want to cut down to make houses? Which do you want to keep together, right? Keep there. until you do the taxonomy, you can't extract the value from the forest, right? You first have to build the knowledge before you build the ship. And then who builds the knowledge? So if it's like in the Spanish case, the state built the knowledge, right? The state had monopoly on the construction of colonial knowledge, and it looks that way as well. It's more programmatic, top-bottom, made them slower, but also more extractivist, enabled them to extract more resources faster.
We've spoken in the past about relationality. It's less relational. It's less local.
Exactly.
It's more global, which is exactly the logic of empire. Right.
It aspires to globality, right? It aspires to universality.
Yeah. Again, because it has to. If you want to dominate an empire, you have to have a system of knowledge that is generalizable, that works the same in England and in the US.
Exactly. So actually, in the English example, you get the opposite because of the people who ended up colonizing the New World, right? You get a construction of knowledge which is more individualistic and therefore translates better into capitalism down the line. I mean, we won't go into the whole thing. Read Howard Zinn and all that stuff.
Yeah.
No reason to retread this here.
By the way, now we can listen to it. Audible Anarchist did an audiobook version of it for free.
That is awesome. Yeah, that's awesome because that's a really long book. So it's cool to have an audible version of it. We're talking about People's History of the United States, by the way. And this has explored in other places, like, of course, Max Weber. We can't really talk about this stuff without mentioning him and stuff like that. So rolling it back. The thing is with the construction of knowledge and what is often overlooked in how knowledge is built is the actual physical spaces and control over them where knowledge is constructed, right? The laboratory, the university, the field excursion, the museum, right? These spaces are infrastructure for the construction of knowledge, right? You need a lab to do experiments. You need a publishing house to print books, and so on and so forth. And Spire does a fantastic job of highlighting the relationship between control over the actual physical space and tools being used and the type of knowledge that is created. The best example is the Vermisian. The Vermisian, personally my favorite plot point of Spire, is a subway system that the Aelfir tried to build into Spire. They try to run a train system through the entirety of the city, and most importantly, through the core buried underneath the earth, the heart, where all weirdness radiates from. And what happened is that when they were tunneling this Vermisian, they tunneled into forbidden places, right? And forbidden knowledge.
They dug too deep.
They dug too deep, exactly. When instead of a Balrog, it's kind of like a Cthulhu thing, right? Awakening and breaking space inside the Vermisian. And now the Vermisian kind of like exists in and out of sync with reality. And for those who are willing to traverse it, holds, you know, like hidden vaults of grimoires and knowledge and scrolls and all that stuff. Now, why is this so relevant to the construction of knowledge? Because one, it's easy to see why this is infrastructural, right? It's literally a subway station. Like, it's very, very infrastructural. The Aelfir see it as a disaster, right? Like this failure of their science and their ability to bend reality to the will. But for the Drow, it's potential. Because now you can go into this broken infrastructural layer and hide inside it yourself, hide knowledge inside of it, act, you know, in a clandestine fashion from out of it, and use like the broken infrastructure for your own purposes. And if that sounds familiar, that's because what happens in reality, right? You use the crumbling city, you use faulty roads. You create faulty roads, right? You know, because you live in a certain city and the police don't, you know where the pavement is not as easy for boots to walk over, and you use all that power for yourself. One example before I stop ranting, in Catalonia, right, in Barcelona, in during the last spate of popular unrest in 2016 or 15, I think this was, well,
against tourism?
No. Against independence, right? Secession.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, the idea of Catalonian secession. Barcelona is the capital of Catalonia and all of Spain. Protesters used their knowledge of byroads to block off police with tractors, right? Like they knew
Amazing.
Which roads the cars that police use, because they don't have 4x4 transmission, all that stuff, they knew how to funnel cops into an area that they can't escape from. So they used the infrastructural space and their knowledge of it, right, to build tactics that allowed them to resist. And that, like, if you recall our campaign Inspire, that's like one of the things you guys did with the barricades, right? Yeah. And that's how barricades came to be, right? Parisians, then Parisians invented the barricade or popularized its modern form, using their knowledge of all these warrens of streets to block off the National Guard in 48 and effectively ensure the revolution by winning in the streets. So Spire does a really good job of the relationship between these knowledges and infrastructure and how they interact.
Yeah, and this is one of the places where playing through it, you know, one of the advantages of it, this being a game, is that you get a different sense of place when you're not reading about it. You're a character traversing the space.
Yeah.
And you get this feeling of when you go to the Elfir places, you know, you're in their turf and that's where they have high control. But like in the shadowy places, in the broken down places, there's more potential probably. I think another real-life example, though I don't know a lot about it, I think some good stuff happens in Detroit after its supposed collapse. You know, there was like regrowth there of people who moved in when the city was almost like a ghost city. So some interesting stuff. And I want to tie this into another element of play, which is... So we've talked about the weirdness of the Aelfir, but let's talk a little bit about the weirdness of the Drow, because they have a different kind of weirdness.
Yeah.
So one thing is the laying eggs thing. So their whole like physiogeny is strange, right? They lay eggs. They have like brood mothers that are kind of midwives. By the way, we've talked about midwives before. Midwives is so interesting. There's a whole thing about like basically abolishing the institution of midwives and how much knowledge was lost. That was, again, relational knowledge. So
and gender knowledge.
Midwives, gendered, yes. I mean, relational in the gendered way, but also in the racialized way.
Yeah,
so
for sure.
So people knowing their communities, knowing what people want, how to kind of ease their pain, make for easier births, and... Just knowledge evaporating, you know, when this scientific knowledge comes and erases it. There are also like examples of like really useful stuff that was forgotten, like midwives knew to wash their hands before they deliver.
Yeah.
And doctors, it wasn't like there wasn't the biological understanding of why you should wash your hands, so they wouldn't do it for a while. So there was actually an increase in child mortality when midwives were abolished. I mean, it wasn't like a swooping thing, you know, you just have modern medicine and slowly the midwife. And so here you have like the character of the midwife, the broodmother, whatever it's called, like these spider-like women who are important figures. But a lot of other weirdness. So some jobs in Spire are kind of standard. So the firebrand is kind of a leader, and I think you have like a fighty guy.
Yeah, you have the knight and the priest and so on.
So the knight is also weird, right? There's a thing where like he doesn't own his own sword. So there are weird stuff about the knight too.
Yeah.
I think so, but some of the characters and the characters I find more kind of appealing are like the Carrion Priest. That's what I played, who like really wants corpses to be devoured by sacred hyenas. That's their thing. And you have the Inksmith, who has all kinds of like weird ideas, weird abilities of spreading rumors or forcing a man with a gun to enter the room for some reason. And so the thing is, you also play weird characters, and they have a different kind of weirdness. They have a weirdness that is used as a tool to achieve their goals, and playing them is interesting because it kind of enamorizes you with the weird. And I want to kind of talk in this context about cringe, about the idea of seeing someone doing something very weird and feeling bad about it, which I think as a leftist is something you feel often. A lot of things that are experienced with in progressive spaces just seem weird. There, you know, people try to go in a circle and everyone talk about their privileges, or, you know, people have gender identities that are complicated and you hear about them and you're like, why do I have to keep track of what's going on with you? Like, there's all this stuff, and a lot of the experience of being in leftist spaces can sometimes make you feel a little bit weird. Like, why are we doing these weird stuff? And I mean, some things can be criticized, sure, if they're bad, but it is an experience. Now, cringe is a very powerful force online. You know, being ridiculous is just something that is very potent, and this power gets wielded by the left and the right. So both sides try to make their opponents seem ridiculous. We've just spoken about how ridiculous, like, Fox News people can often seem. But it's important to know that this idea of, like, cringe, of like, looking at someone being like, how weird is this? We should remember that that's always a reactionary tendency. It's a power that maybe we can wield in isolated cases, but we should always be careful about, because it is reactionary power. It's a power of looking at the different and hating it and having a gut reaction of disgust, which is always an emotion that we should be very kind of wary of.
Yeah.
And I just think that part of being a leftist is, like, being in all these weird situations and just accepting that it's okay to do some weird stuff. It's okay to experiment with, you know, gender is complicated. Some people are genderqueer and don't feel, like, exactly accepted. So we're going to do a bunch of weird shit. And I read somewhere that someone said, like, I don't get why we do pronoun circles. It doesn't seem to serve the people who have different pronouns. They just seem embarrassed about it. And I was like, maybe they're embarrassed about it, but if people go around and say their pronouns, at least they know that there are people who are willing to do that effort. And that is a signal of safety, because that just means that people are willing to do the ritual, basically. And there's a bunch of shit like that, you know. Again, it can get frustrated, the whole point of privilege stuff. Like, people, I get why some people get frustrated. You need to, like, make sure that you're not alienating people who don't speak the lingo. There's a bunch of problems in that respect. But at least for the kind of people, I don't know, that we are, you know, coming into leftism with a lot of privilege and, you know, having the time to kind of like learn and, you know, having enough of a voice in the world that we can be quiet sometimes, I think it's really good to familiarize yourself with the idea of being weird, of being... not yourself being weird, not like, ooh, I'm so weird. Just getting used to...
I think that's exactly where Lenin comes in. And what I wanted to talk about when I wanted to talk about Lenin. I mean, it's not just Lenin, just he wrote a very famous pamphlet on it, on adventurism, mm-hmm. right?
Sure.
The pamphlet is called Adventurism, published in 1914. And the idea here is this, it's not a very deep text, right? It's a pamphlet. But it's a cry against groups that basically see the revolution as a pastime or are interested in causing specific ripples, but not creating long-term change, right? And it asks, you know, Marxists and Marxist workers to look beyond just the words that these groups are saying and to look at the actions of what they actually do. I think that is super, super relevant to what you're saying and to what Spire is saying, and can actually be a criticism of Spire.
Mm-hmm.
So, first of all, regarding pronouns and all that stuff, this is a conversation that I've had many times with people who, you know, don't really get it. Maybe they're a bit older, or maybe they'll just come from a different sort of political background. They're like, what is the point of all these pronouns and also other words? Like, why can't I say specific words? And what I always tell them is, mm-hmm. I don't actually care about the words that you say. Like, the words that you say in a vacuum, the word itself is a neutral series of sounds, right? Like, it, objectively, quote-unquote, goo-goo-gaga and racism are the same thing, right? There are a bunch of vibrations created by a voice box in my throat that I manipulate the air with.
Sure.
What I actually care is, A, the social conditions which give the word meaning, but also the internal states that they hint at. So when you say the N-word, right? Or when you say,
mm-hmm.
when you don't use someone's pronouns, or when you use the R word, right? When you use the word retarded as a slur. What I care about is the hate and anger and cruelty that these words hint at. I don't care about the actual words. I care about what they tell me about how you see reality, right? And about how you think about things. And the people who criticize you just for the word and won't go deeper to criticize the actual states that those words imply, they are adventurist, right? They are only interested in the flavor of the day. And that's, of course, most liberals, right? They only care about the current trend, what is cool to call out, but not the question, okay, but where does this thing come from? Like, we've all seen the screenshots and the memes of liberals saying, oh, a perfect example is REI, which is a clothing chain. The workers in the New York branch, which I've visited often and have shopped at often, and I really like it, they want to unionize. And in response, the company released a podcast saying, don't unionize, right? And unions are terrible and all that shit, and we're going to fight you and fire and all that stuff. And it opens with a land acknowledgement. Right? They're like,
What?
yes, my name is Helen, a fake name. I don't remember the actual name. I am the CFO for REI, and I'm speaking to you from Mi'kmaq appropriated land. And the other guy who is in a different part of the US is like, yes, I am standing on, I don't remember which tribes they actually use, right?
Sure.
On
And now
Cherokee.
let's suppress the workers together.
Exactly. And then once we're done with the land acknowledgement, unions are bad and you shouldn't unionize because they only care for the sound their mouths are making. They don't actually want to interrogate what lies behind it. Now, how does this apply to Spire? Spire's conception of how resistance works is very individualist, right? You work as a group of individuals. Okay, that's fine.
Well, it's like basically a terrorist
Yeah,
cell,
exactly.
type of freedom fighter cell.
Exactly. So, and what you do is, the idea is you do enough terror and more terror, and that kind of like convinces people that they can rise up against the powers that be, and that enables the masses to rise. That doesn't work, and has not worked historically. Interestingly enough, in Adventurism, Lenin's pamphlet, one of the groups that he mentions is Narodnaya Volya, right? The People's Council. These are groups of terrorists that tried to kill the Tsar several times and did other acts of terror and failed in Russia. They worked for like 2 decades, and famously, they led into all this like cat and mouse games with detectives and informers and stuff like that. And then even it spun off into the first years of the Bolshevik movement. You know, this idea that Stalin was a police provocateur and all that stuff. It comes from this Russian tradition of individual cells united against a loose ideology that commit acts of terror in the hope of if you do enough terror, then the government will collapse. But that's not how revolutions worked. Like in their case, it was a misreading of what happened in France. And in current times, there's a misreading of what worked in Russia and what worked after and before it. This idea that, and again, I'm sorry, this is an anarchist podcast, but neither you nor I are full anarchists, right? We think that anarchism has good ideas and stuff to learn from, but that's its
I
limitation.
just think it's restrictive to be a
Yeah,
somethingist.
for
I
sure.
can describe myself as a leftist because I am in enough of an agreement with enough leftist ideology that I
Yeah.
think that captures everything, but
I
I don't like being a
yeah,
somethingist.
I'm a centrist. I'm in the center between Lenin and anarchy.
Yeah,
so
I think you've made that joke before.
I have. It's one of my favorite jokes. So but bringing it all back together, like that's the limitation with anarchy. How do you go from a group of 40 people in Seattle declaring an autonomous zone to the collapse of the United States? Right? Like how does that happen? And that's a question that Spire, I think, again, great game. I loved playing it, and the ideas are good, but that's one of the criticisms you can make of it. Like, how does it actually come together? How do you go from disparate cells working across the city, sniping at the Aelfheel hegemony, to the collapse of oppression? Right? And this is exactly Lenin's critique, right? Like, if you think about also about people from our social economical background, a lot of the criticism that they levy on themselves is like, I don't go to protests anymore, I don't fight with cops, I don't like, you know, throw stones, I don't break windows anymore. And like, okay, but what do those things ever do for us, right? What does it actually get you beyond cool stories, cool bruises, right? Like chicks dig scars kind of thing. And that's it, because you went on an adventure. Even if you levy like stuff at, you know, reputable and I think serious and honestly fine Israeli groups, right? Like Anarchists Against the Fence, right? What did they actually do? They went to Benin every single weekend for 15 fucking years and fought with the cops. And what the fuck happened? Nothing happened. Because there wasn't the next step of mass organizing, returning to the workers, returning to the mass line, trying to form a party. All these things which history tells us are a necessity for revolution to actually succeed. And those are completely absent from Spire.
Yeah, I have a memory of canvassing with like a volunteer group, and one of the people was like a 16-year-old kid, and I was, I don't know, 22 or something. And we both had just watched the movie Five Broken Cameras, which, if you want like depressing movies about the Israeli occupation, that's one of the hardest ones to watch, because you see how callous the occupation is and how it doesn't give a shit. And there's a scene there that is just heartbreaking, where basically you have really peaceful protesters like just trying to save some of their lands from the separation fence, and there's like a line of soldiers just waiting to beat them up, and there's a guy like in the front of the protest like yelling at the soldiers, and at one point like one person behind him throws a rock, and it's obviously just someone who got pissed off, and the rock doesn't hit anyone, and it's just like a gesture, and you see the guy like turn around, and he knows what's gonna happen, and he's like looking behind him and is so disappointed and sad, and like, why? And the soldiers just like rush everyone and start like maiming people, and it's just, it's a heartbreaking movie. And the guy I was talking to said, like, watching that movie made me want to go to the fence and throw rocks at soldiers. And I was like, how did you get that? How did you get that feeling? Don't you realize what happens when you throw rocks at soldiers? It doesn't work.
Yeah.
I mean, that's literally in the movie. Like, I get it. You get violent urges. It is very frustrating. But you have to look beyond your initial urge. Now, I'll go into a different point than the one I wanted to talk about, and I'll close with this one. And I think that actually I do like where Spire lands on this question, because Spire, and it's in the same page too with like the principles of Spire. Spire admits that you can't beat the Elfir by doing what you're doing in Spire. And like I think it says there, like there's always another level, and your own group might sell you out. It's a very kind of like defeated position that the book takes. And I think this is like a very, like the critique of adventurism is very valid. I think it's something that we should definitely think about. And I think we've mentioned this in a couple of times, even like when we were talking about Merdieu, we talked about like, you know, being in the position of not knowing what to do. And how that's a very familiar feeling to me, like to read about the protagonist that doesn't know who, like, what to do. So I think, like, on the one hand, like, one side of the tightrope that you don't want to fall into is just doing things for the sake of it, right? The other side that you don't want to fall into is just doing
never doing anything,
Because anything can be defeated by this logic.
And that's why I'm a centrist, right?
Yeah, and I think the place that like Spire tries to kind of like put you in, like the mindset, and that's what you play, is you have to know that you are likely not going to change anything. But you kind of have to keep a fire going. And the way I like to think about it is, you can't, like, you're not gonna know that you think that you do will make a difference. But also, you have to think that if difference happens, it will include people doing what you're doing necessarily. So if no one does the thing that you're doing, definitely nothing will change. So, I mean, that's a very, like, small comfort, right? But when I do things like, I don't know, make a podcast about anarchist stuff or like talk to people, I'm like, I can't say that like the dozen people that are gonna listen to this podcast or like the people that I can convince in my like small sphere of influence are ever gonna influence a change in the world. But I also know that if no one ever spoke about these ideas, obviously nothing would happen. So like it's a tightrope where like you have to be aware of both things and still, I don't know, be able to get yourself activated. And that's why I think it's important, and I think it also relates to this point about weirdness, that you know, when you mentioned that the autonomous zone was definitely adventurous and there were a lot of critiques of it. And I don't know like the details, but I think something important to keep in mind is like, you know, people are just trying to do some shit and you like nobody knows, and like the insurmountable problem, you know, I mentioned throwing rocks at soldiers, like the state now has this kind of huge bureaucratic power that it can deploy so easily to crush anything. That's like the point of opening. It seems like we've already lost, and maybe like one thing to do is just to think and to wait for an opportunity to change something. But another thing is just to do some shit. As long as, again, you're like taking care, like not like you could be harming something, you could be exacerbating
Yeah, I
conditions. You
think.
shouldn't be an accelerationist. You shouldn't like
Yeah.
you shouldn't provoke the police. There was a whole thing about white people like picking fights with the police during
Yeah.
BLM, and like you know the people who are gonna get beat up are black people. Like don't do that shit. Let someone else lead the
I
protest.
think to maybe tie a bow around this discussion and bring this episode to an end, I super agree with what you just said. It's about laying the seeds, right? Is your non-adventurism, right? These individualistic things that you keep doing, are they doing what Spire would like you to believe that you're doing in the game, right? Setting the ground for something bigger, reminding people that the state is not invincible, it can be resisted in many ways. Are you doing that, or are you just venting? If you're venting, that's also okay, but don't pretend that it's something more than that. And by the way, we're both good Marxists. It depends on your conditions, right? I would never, ever in my life tell a Palestinian not to throw rocks at tanks, right? In
Oh,
their.
sure. I don't think that's what was.
Oh, no, of course not, but I'm making it explicit. Because in the conditions of the oppressed or the dominated, then even the smallest act of quote unquote adventurism, what might be adventurism in a different context, here is truly radical because it says the possibility of resistance still exists. And I think that's what Spire is trying to say, right? The Elfir are dominated. Sorry, the Drow are dominated by the Elfir. And in their situation, where every single person around you is cowed and beaten down, then any act you do, whether it is planned or just venting or this very quick manifestation of violence is radical because it says resistance is possible. And then you gotta ask yourself, what are these acts? And this is maybe where Spire fails. What are these acts all leading up to? What am I setting the ground for? How does the next step look after that, right? And to react to it and to keep resistance running more than just, here we are. Fuck you, right? That's a good first step, but it's not anywhere near the last step, and it's not even a second step.
My final thought on this is like this is something that people who speak about mutual aid talk about a lot, where they say like at least we're building power in our communities. At least we're building a more robust community. We don't know if we can like organize a rebellion to defeat capitalism, but we can make it so that people are more resilient. So maybe they're more ready for the next stage.
That was Spire.
Yeah, great game. Like,
Yes.
again, talking about it and talking about the themes is one thing. You really experience it if playing with like a competent GM as Aiden is. And
yeah, it's a great game. You should totally play it, and then also play Heart, which we haven't played yet and is very different, but touches on some of the same. You can play an Aelfir in Heart, by the way, because everyone in Heart under the ground is like disgraced, including the Aelfir, which is an interesting take that we might explore in the future.
It's funny, role-playing games are themselves the kind of weird that
yes,
like you get used to, like you get used to being a little bit cringe yourself, which is a good
yes for sure. We don't know what we're doing next time, but we'll figure something out. What have you been doing other than that you want to talk about?
Yeah, I don't know if I've mentioned reading How Propaganda Works last time we spoke.
Oh,
that's
yeah.
That's what I'm reading right now.
Yeah.
And I just got to something that relates to our discussion. He talks about slurs and how slurs are kind of manufactured. So
he is Jason Stanley, by the way.
Jason Stanley, yeah. Yes. And the idea is to make a linguistic analysis of propaganda with philosophy of language.
Mm-hmm.
And he talks about slurs. He defines slurs as words that are meant to change your perception of like the order of people, such that like some people are considered lesser. And in that extent, he says like propagandists are always trying to manufacture new slurs. And his example is welfare. Welfare in the US is a slur meant to make you think about black people as lazy.
Yeah. Interesting.
Which is really interesting. And, you know, you mentioned, you know, not saying the N-word. You know, the N-word is a slur. It's like a word that is meant to make you feel that black people are lesser.
Yes.
The power of like, preventing people from being able to say the N-word is just, like, a step in the opposite direction, right? It's saying, no, you should be scared to say this word because black people are not lesser. They also have power. And it's like a manifestation of that power. So by having the social norm, it's a kind of this isn't a Jason Stanley argument. This is a me argument, unless someone else made it, and I'm just unaware of. So it's basically a manifestation of power. So by holding to this standard, by holding other people to this standard, by telling other people like no, don't say the N word, even if you're quoting someone, just don't. The rule is that you don't. You're just manifesting power. The meaning of your utterance is, you know, black people aren't inferior. They're worthy of your consideration. This is a word that they've chosen to not be an available word. So just respect that.
Yeah. Yeah.
What about you?
So I got to guest on the Acid Horizon podcast. Very interesting podcast focused mainly on Deleuze and stuff like that. But they have like the side podcast, a podcast within a podcast, if you will, called Inner Experiences, or Inner Experience, where they talk about the occult from this radical and philosophical perspective. And I got to talk about my essay about that you helped me write, by the way, about magic realism as a radical
oh,
thing,
yeah.
And a Marxist analysis of
one of your best ones.
Thank you. Magical realism. I started this essay like 4 years ago. I put it in a Google Doc and I tagged Yanai, and he offered some comments. And then like 3 years later, or 3.5 years later, I watched On Becoming a God in Central Florida, which is a TV show, and everything kind of clicked. And then I sat down and wrote this essay. So I got to guest on their podcast. Just Google Acid Horizon podcast and you'll find it's the latest episode. We talk about stuff.
Yeah, we'll link that in the show notes too.
Yeah, cool. So anybody listening to this would be interested in what we talk about there. We talk about Jack Vance and D&D and High Magic and Le Guin and Borges and a bunch of other stuff, and Buber, of course. And this idea of high fantasy and high magic as reactionary and conservative, and magical realism is having the potential to be radical and resisted. By the way, I could have turned this entire episode on Spiral on to another discussion about magical realism, but I specifically didn't because I've been speaking a lot about it in the last 24 hours. But totally, we can talk about the weirdness and how magic works and how it's understood and Aelfir versus Drow magic. So instead of talking about it here, you can go and listen to the episode there and imagine that everything I'm saying there, I'm also saying about Spiral. And that's it.
Incredible. So, we don't know what we'll talk about next time, but if you want to hit just a treasure trove of weird anarchist science fiction, and also some non-weird anarchist science fiction, you can go to anarchysf.com.
Yep.
And thank you for listening.
See you next time.
See ya.
Bye.